Very nice to see you. I need my cheat sheet. It's all the way over here. You know, it's very grounding to come out here and see you all before we start. I'm sure that the musicians would decline this opportunity, but it would be nice if we could all come out and say hi before we start. It makes you realize that this is really important, and that's what music does, right? And tonight's music is really, there's about every flavor you can imagine in each of these works. And each composer gives us a roadmap to discovering something that that is really interesting, and each piece a very different way of exploring different feelings, different places, different experiences, different ways of composing, different compositional techniques. And it's just wonderful for you to come and hear this without you bringing it alive in your oral imagination. What we're doing doesn't matter. And it's such a unique art form, music is. I mean, where is it? You know, it's written down on a piece of paper and we're reading it off of the stand. There's notes on a page that don't have any meaning until they're played, and then it's there and we hear it and then it's gone. And the best way to have that experience is the way you are right now, in a shared live experience. You know, where is the music otherwise? It's in our experience of it. And so each of these roadmaps tonight is really unique. So for Rimsky-Korsakov, I like to think of him, you know, at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Harrison Ford goes somewhere and there's a red dashy line. Rimsky-Korsakov was a really well-traveled naval officer. That was his first love, was the sea. And he wanted to be a sailor, and he was, but by the time he shipped off on his, I think, years-long sort of around-the-world tour, he really got serious about composition. And in fact, he brought Berlioz's treatise on orchestration with him and memorized the whole thing, and brought compositions he was working on to keep active. I think there was a piano on the boat. And he was exposed to a variety of different cultural influences from all the places he went, including Northern Spain. And in my study of this wonderful piece we're going to play that really shows off the talent in this orchestra rooted entirely in your community, I learned a lot about the northern region of Spain that's got all that Celtic influence. I mean, they played bagpipes, and the primary folk dance that Rimsky-Korsakov uses to anchor his Capriccio Español is in fact a dance. It's a song for the morning. It's a dawn song. He plays this song. It's called an Alborada. He plays it three times. It's sort of the anchor for the whole work. And it's rooted in this folk tradition that he probably encountered on the street. And I encountered it fishing around YouTube. And I wish that I could show you the video. It's these wonderful ladies and a few gentlemen in traditional Spanish folk attire, kind of a little ridiculous. And they're playing bagpipes, and you'll hear the drone of the bagpipes. You'll hear the rattle of the tambourine, and you'll hear the wailing melody of everyone sort of hollering out the tune. And this is sort of the root material for that Alborada that you'll hear in the Rimsky-Korsakov. So it might be a little shocking. Here's the Alborada. Not a very great quality recording, but you get the idea. So Rimsky-Korsakov, many of you probably know, was really known for his ability to draw out incredible variety and detail, color of sound in his use of the orchestra. Lots of composers were good at this, but there's something about Rimsky-Korsakov. He taught everyone else how to do it, first of all, people like Stravinsky and Ravel and Respighi. But for him, especially in this piece, the orchestration is as important as the melody. It's as important as the rhythm. It's in and of itself a musical element. It's not just dressing up a melody in different outfits, you know? So listen to how he takes that, what you just heard, the essence of that sound, the drone in the bagpipes is gonna be in low brass, and the bass drum and cymbals and the low strings, and the tambourine and the triangle you'll hear, and you'll hear the melody in the upper voices and the beginning of the wail in the of the melody in the clarinet. So here's Rimsky-Korsakov's take on that traditional alborada. There's a million solos in the piece. Well, not a million, several. I never exaggerate at all. Period plot, not once. What follows that alborada is a series of variations on a very beautiful lyrical tune that shares the shape of the fandango that you'll hear at the end and of the gypsy song that follows the variations. And each section of the orchestra takes a turn, starting with the horns. You'll hear a very lyrical, slow passage. Eventually the whole string section takes it up and you'll see lots of activity here. You'll also hear lots of unique pizzicato flourishes and lots of harmonics, and they're going to be really, really busy over here achieving all the effects that Rimsky-Korsakov asks for. And then toward the latter part of the Capriccio, we hear a gypsy song that is varied over and over again and builds to a big climax. This is the gypsy song. It starts a little quietly. You'll hear that a lot in a variety of different ways. In rehearsal, there's a challenge in there. There's an accent that comes on the first note after the downbeat. So instead of da 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 da, it's da da. And it's really hard not to accent the first note. And I remember in rehearsal saying, okay, we just don't accent the first note. And the feeling in the room was, but it's so fun to play. It's really hard not to. And that is really true. This is a really fun, it's very hard to play, but it's a really fun piece to play. And following that gypsy song, we build and build into the entrance of the fandango asturiante, which is another traditional folk dance of the northern Spain region. And it just, you know, we just generate all manner of energy until the last note. So hopefully we'll have you bouncing out of your seats at the end. And the last work on the program, there's really nothing similar between Dvorak and Rimsky-Korsakov. The character of the two pieces is wildly different. Although they live in almost exactly the same time period, their music is very dissimilar. There's not a lot of connection there. But what's interesting is a lot of the technical work that the strings do in the Rimsky-Korsakov, the arpeggiation, happens in the Dvorak. The melodies are full of leaping triadic up the scale. There's even a few arpeggios that happen so fast that they almost sound like the ricochet-like bowing that you'll hear. So even without an actual connection, there are these similarities. Dvorak's Seventh Symphony is, you know, all the rest of the symphonies are kind of over here, and then there's the Seventh Symphony. It's its own thing, and has a different character and quality. I mean, you can hear Dvorak in it, of course, but there's something else going on. I would love to be inside the mind of this composer at the time he's writing this piece. My understanding is that around this time, his mother died, and Smetana, his mentor, had, I think, become mentally ill, and it was quite devastating. He had also just heard Brahms' Third Symphony, which was an epically huge influence on this piece. And Brahms was a door opener for Dvorak. Brahms introduced Dvorak to Simrock, his publisher, which is how Dvorak sort of started to make it and earn money. And there was a deep relationship there. But there's something about the way Dvorak composes this piece. His thematic, the melodic material is incredibly dense, deeply rich, full of material. So every theme can be taken apart and combined differently and fragmented or expanded in a way that allows for the exploration of a really deep range of emotion. So I'd like to give you a few things to hang your hat on and give you a taste of the themes of some of the movements. So the first theme of the first movement, it starts with a low sort of hum, a low D in the orchestra. It's in D minor, and the first theme really stays right in the first three notes of D minor and noodles around, sort of an upper neighbor and a lower neighbor. Da 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 dee da 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 da. It stays really close. And then he breaks that rhythm apart. You hear the first two notes, da 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 da, those two little notes become very important, da da da. And they take on a whole flavor and character of their own. Here's the first theme of the first movement.
Thank you.
joins. And here again, you hear a lot of I don't want to say a lot of Brahms, but it's true, you do hear a lot of Brahms. I feel like it steals a little from Dvorak to constantly compare him to Brahms. But in many ways, Dvorak out-Brahmses Brahms in this movement. there's suddenly a change in the music. It's a subtle but very dramatic change. There's a moment in this movement twice where everything seems to stop. You lose sense of what is the rhythm, what is our tonality, where are we going, and it feels like suspended animation, and we're lost for a time until we're found again. I want to play that moment for you where this suspended animation happens. It's not really it's a theme, but it's more of a transitional one. Slavonic dances, and the trick to it that is both really wonderful to listen to, really fun to play, is that its theme is really two themes in two different ways of counting, two different meters. So the first aspect of the first theme is in three. And the second aspect happens at the exact same time, is in two. So it's all the way through. This is the scherzo. Brings back some of the darkness of the first movement. The theme you hear right from the beginning is reaching up, like as if to rescue oneself, and then you fail and plunge right into dissonance. So the first theme is this: it's a rising octave, a descent into this very disturbingly dissonant chord, and then kind of a hymn-like conclusion, almost like calming itself down. Here's that first theme of the last movement. And from there, he sort of searches for the next idea and returns to this theme, but the reach upward in the octave is so much more desperate that it's filled out in that arpeggiated way I told you about that the violins are doing the whole night long. Dum-la-dum-la-dum, all the way up. Here's the fully fleshed out full first theme. But I need to leave some of it for live experience. And this, you know, roadmap that Dvorak left us that we're bringing to life tonight is it's so beautiful, so personal. It's hard to talk about. It's hard to describe. Why bother? You should just listen. and in the center of our concert tonight is a really uniquely beautiful, wonderful opportunity that we have. First of all, I've been incredibly blessed in the last 2 years to, through a series of wonderful coincidences and one small accident, meet Evan Kahn, the wonderful cellist who's sitting in about 9 different orchestras in the Bay Area right now, thank goodness. His musical spirit is huge, and his interests are wide and varied, and he's playing tonight a piece composed by his father, who I've also just recently met, and also giving us a taste of Dvorak just before we dive into the symphony. And I'm so happy in the midst of these two other composers who are long ago and far away beyond us, we have George Kahn, Evan's father, who wrote this piece with us tonight. They're both gonna come out and join me, which is why there's 3 chairs here. Evan and George, you wanna come on out? Your music is wonderful. It speaks deeply to me. And I was just asking Evan after rehearsal, what was that, last night? Night before last? Write more! Write more! I'd love to just learn a little bit more about you both.
What do you want to know?
did you enjoy your dinner tonight? No. Who made your jacket? No. George, let me start with you, because I actually know the least about you. You're a jazz pianist, right?
Correct, yeah. Jazz pianist, composer, based in Los Angeles. I have 9 albums out, and you can find it on Spotify and Amazon and Pandora, George Kahn Pandora Station, like it is. But I'm a classically trained composer. Studied at Brandeis University back in 1969 to 1973, and then moved to Los Angeles to pursue a music career. Studied with a couple of different film composers in Los Angeles.
I would love to know more. I mean, having studied your piece, I mean, you'll hear in it, it's very tonal. It's very it's not traditionally tonal, right. But it's. The harmonic language is very comfortable, and there's 12 tone rows throughout it, and many of you know what I'm speaking of, but for those who don't, 12 tone rows, generally speaking, are quite dissonant. But it's very comfortable, the way you move with fluidity. How do you achieve that? Okay, does that work?
That's a good question. Again, I don't know how many people understand what a 12-tone row is, but basically there's 12 tones in the scale, and in the 12-tone row, you play each note once before you repeat any of them. And this was an idea that was brought up by Schoenberg back at around the turn of the century, the idea being that tonality is like, we're done with tonality. Everything's been done with tonality. So now let's create a system where every note is given equal weight, therefore it's technically atonal. So that was the original idea behind the 12-tone row. However, there's a lot of tonality within the 12-tone row. So the composer I studied with most, teacher was a guy named Lyle Spud Murphy in Los Angeles. He taught something called the equal interval system, which was the concept that you don't have whole steps and half steps, you have steps. And each note can have its own weight, and each note can have its own tonal center. So with this piece, there is a tonal center that's very clear. It shifts throughout the piece, though. And the tone row kind of sits on top of that. So the tone row will, at times, will sound like it's in one key, and it might sound like it's in a different key, depending on what's happening underneath it.
Yeah, the way I personally like to think about it in your piece, but also in contemporary composition, you don't generally find composers trying to write super atonal 12-tone music all that much anymore.
It didn't go so well before.
With my dad's piece, the point is not the fact that we are incorporating all 12 notes.
Right.
Like, with a lot of the music that is generally, actually, in the general populace looked at in distaste, the point is the math of it, right? The point is the concept behind it, not what we're actually hearing. With my dad's music, the row, the 12-tone row, is subservient to the music. And that makes all the difference.
Right, and if you were to analyze it, you'd find that I cheat.
Good.
So the 12-tone row will show up, but it might be 13 tones, or there might be only the first nine, or, so it's not a rigid interpretation, but the whole piece does, all three movements really come out of one kernel of this 12-tone row. That's where the genesis of the piece is.
I like what you said, though, because what it does, to me, to my ears, what you just said is it brings the technical aspects back into what does it sound like? How does it feel?
Does it sound good?
Does it sound good? Yes, indeed. And it's a piece full of variety. There's a rainstorm and a dance in it. But there's, to my ears, the dance rhythms of the last movement, you know, we're warming up for that with our dancing at the beginning of the program. And I would imagine, I mean, knowing as I've become more familiar with your sort of career so far, outside of just our collaborations and your work in orchestral life, you're also doing some pretty outside the box music making, aren't
Always.
You?
Always.
Yes, tell us a little.
I have so many cakes and eat them all. I play in a lot of ensembles and a lot of different kinds of music. One day I'll be playing a contemporary opera based on Moby Dick. Another day I'll be playing a Beethoven string quartet the next day, and then the next day I'll be playing incredibly dissonant and a phenomenal piece by a French composer named Gerard Brise called Vortex Temporum, which is still one of the hardest pieces I've ever had to learn. You know, that variety is wonderful and important to me.
Do you also play jazz? Are you also any other like?
No.
No, that's fine.
And not to spike him.
We have actually improvised.
Yeah.
Every now and then.
But that's not jazz.
Well, not no, not.
That's like Fields of Gold.
Yes.
That's like Joni Mitchell. You
know, in the middle of that.
But like I'm not trained in jazz improv.
Right.
I'm good at other kinds of improv, but like throw a lead sheet in front of me and I'm like, what do you want me to do here? No, no thank you. Give this to a bass player. That's why they play bass.
And there's some jazz bass in this piece for sure. Oh,
there is, yes, yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Have you collaborated in this way, you've written this piece for you. Are there other pieces you've written, or are there other things that you've collaborated on?
Not really.
Or just
no, not yet.
This
was a piece came about gradually. First movement came very quickly when Evan was in high school, and then the second two movements I composed throughout his college.
Yeah, you brush over the fact that you wrote the first movement in 3 weeks.
That's fast.
So, it's very fast. Like, composers generally take a long time to write music. To be fair, I'm sure he's about to say he had the ideas mulling around in his head for years and then just sort of wrote them down. But when he came up to me, I was a senior in high school, and my high school I went to a public school and was fortunate enough to go to a school with a very nice music program that had some of us auditioned to play pieces with the orchestra before our graduation, a thing called senior gala. Very hoity-toity, wonderful. My dad came up to me and said, hey, I want to write you a piece for a senior gala. And I said, what? You, classical piece? He said, yeah. Like, when was the last time you wrote like a classical piece of music? Like 20 years ago. What, why makes you think you can do this? Watch me. And he wrote it down, and there it was. And I said, oh, this is amazing. This is an amazing piece of music. And then, and then he wrote the other two. Sorry, I think that's
okay. Yeah, the other two movements took about 4 years, so.
It comes out a lot.
Yeah, exactly. But there is a, to kind of elaborate a little bit on what Evan said, I have honestly an amazing gift at this point where I do compose in my head, and when I sit down, it's pretty much there,
Wow. More
often than not. So it's an unusual gift, and it's something I do appreciate.
Can you share some of that? We would love to tap in with a direct line.
I wish I could.
Well, we'll get some of it tonight. We only have a minute really to go before we should let everybody. But should we sort of set up a few signposts for what there? Do you want to describe a little bit of how this piece progresses?
Sure. The first movement starts sort of deep in your belly. In the basses and in the low strings, this sort of rumble, sort of a coming storm feel. And the piece in the orchestra, anyway, progresses upward into the violins. There's a moment sort of right in the middle of that first movement where everyone sort of comes together in this grandiose moment. I have a cadenza, sort of where I'm just playing myself. Sort of come out of that sound, and then the violins float off to heaven, so to speak. And then the beginning of the second movement after that sort of moment of stasis, I play another cadenza that brings us into a sort of closer, more tender place in the second movement. Tender, but also moving, and feels very, it flows. Yeah, like a river. And then that river sort of comes from this wide place to a very narrow point at the end. And this pizzicato, all the strings pluck a note right at the end of the second movement. And that pluck gives way to a lot of plucks. A lot of plucks throughout the orchestra, and this rainstorm starts sort of percolating. And that rainstorm comes from this sort of varied and these string players playing in very disparate places, and suddenly they sort of come together to this dance. And that's where the piece sort of finishes, is where all the strings just come together and I with them to play this very Latin-inspired dance. Really fun.
It is really fun. We've had a really good time preparing it, and it's a real privilege to be able to try our hand at it and bring it to life with the two of you in this space with these musicians. It's a wonderful gift for you to generate for us. So thank you.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you, and I appreciate the Livermore Amador Orchestra for taking on this.
We're happy to do it. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me out here too, and hope you enjoy the show.